Welcome to the 47th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm David Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that thinks Joe Root should have hit back.
A quick spoiler alert, we're not going to be talking about the Ashes at all this episode, but we are going to be reviewing what's happened in the Champions Trophy so far and what's still to come. Andy's going to be introducing us to the mysteries of the Carrom Ball. We're going to be reviewing Peter Oborne's book on Basil Dodavira. And we've got a fascinating interview with Chris Smith of the blog Declaration Game. But before that, what's caught your eye in the recent events?
Well, too often we have these endless moans about how batsmen are having it too easy. You know, we saw the great fuss in the IPL over Chris Gayle's massive innings, and we're kind of getting used to and maybe a bit less impressed by batsmen smashing all over the place. Which is why I really enjoyed the Pakistan-West Indies game at the Oval, where batsmen definitely did not have it in their own way, and Kimar Roach and Wahab Riaz, for their respective sides, were just dominant. And it just was a reminder to me of how much fun it is watching pace bowlers just with raw speed and raw aggression, just getting on top of batsmen. I mean, both Roach and Riaz at times were completely unplayable. And in many ways, they weren't doing sort of ludicrous things in terms of swinging the balls. A lot of it was just good old-fashioned, like hurrying the batsmen, rushing them. I mean, there was a spell where Riaz bowled to Pollard, where Pollard just couldn't get a bat on ball. And it was good fun, and just this reminder of the importance that we both get, batsmen and bowlers having their moment.
There has been something in this. I've actually really enjoyed this Champions Trophy.
It's been great stuff,
and there's sort of been something for everyone, in a way. And as you say, there's been some real raw pace. There have been some really big innings. There have been some really, we are reminded of how exciting a low scoring game can be. And actually, we've seen a massive great range of different types, because usually
it's one of those cliches that annoys me when people trot it out when they say, oh, the low scoring games are the best, but it is kind of true as well. We've seen that Sri Lanka New Zealand game where it was absolutely classic.
And actually, in the context of that, there's been, it seems to me, particularly during this tournament, a lot of talk of people very early on in innings trying to establish, oh, is this a 250 pitch, is this a 300 pitch, is this a more than 300 pitch. And actually, one of the things that I have been quite impressed with England about is, actually, I think that they've hit on a bit of a, well, when I say a winning formula, you're going to come back at me and say that they haven't won all their games yet, but I have actually been quite impressed by the way that they've sort of stuck to their guns. And they have said that we are going to have an approach to the game that is based on building a really solid foundation at the top of the order with Bell and Cook and Trott, and then having batsmen who can come in at the end and score odd runs. And we saw it work quite well against Australia. We saw it work well against Sri Lanka, I thought. Owen Morgan coming in after, I think he came after in over after about 41 overs. Perhaps a little bit too late. But anyway, they scored... Nigh on 300 in that Sri Lanka game, and actually I think it's a bit of a vindication of Andy Flower's level-headedness that he's actually stuck with that approach rather than bowing to public pressure.
I think there are sort of two problems with that, in that the first being that I think England are making do with what they have to a considerable extent, and I think,
but every team has to make do.
They do make with what they have, but the idea that it is in some way the ideal strategy to kind of knock it around and play safe for 30 overs, I'm just not sold by. I'm convinced that, and I mean, I really feel like Kevin Peterson at number three, even Kevin Peterson opening, would transform this England side in a real positive way, and I realise that's no one's fault that he isn't there. And I feel like England, to a considerable extent, are making the best with what they've got, and that's respectable. I also slightly wonder that this problem of expecting players like Morgan and Butler to come in and lift off with sort of 10, 15 overs again is fantastic when it works, but does put a huge amount of pressure on them. I mean, Butler in that ODI against New Zealand before the series started did something quite astonishing. I haven't got the biggest hand, but quite extraordinary. Yeah. It hasn't really clicked in the Champions Trophies yet,
But they have at least scored some fairly solid tables. And I think the problem is that actually, I think that is a safer option than, and of course there is that risk of them needing to lift off in the last sort of 10, 15 overs, you're completely right. But it's a safer option than, you know, the old way that we used to have of kind of trying, experimenting with opening with Matt Prior, say, where if you suddenly find yourself four down, you're kind of neither one nor the other. You neither have a solid base nor you have batsmen with explosive pace to come in later.
And I mean, what one thing, this endless Jonathan Trott debate that kind of bores me to tears, actually, because it just goes round and round and round. It was interesting, before the podcast started, we were comparing Sangakkara, he of the brilliant innings against England, and him and Trott have very comparable strike rates, both, in mid-70s strike rates. And I think it is an interesting reminder, actually, that we get used to this 2020 idea of how you've got to be a runner ball, and actually, ODIs don't tend to work like that.
And as well, I think the case with the Sri Lankan English game, the Kumar Sangakkara innings was absolutely remarkable. But I think the thing that England need to sort is that they look completely clueless in the middle of an innings when they're bowling, if it's not swinging and it's not reverse swinging.
Mm.
And that was really where, I mean, Sri Lanka should never have got there with, I mean, it was kind of 25 balls to spare or something. They got there comfortably with the run rate. And if there's, I think England basically have more problems with their bowling than they do with their batting.
So away from the Champions Trophy, there have been some interesting proposals knocking about for the future of the County Championship. They've been getting you hot and bothered.
They have been getting me hot and bothered, and if the ECB have their way, they'll be getting quite a few county players hot and bothered as well. So last episode I was singing the praises of the ECB for their strategic review, which I thought was actually quite sensible, but now there is this proposal, and at the moment it is just a proposal, and I'm not sure how seriously it's been taken, that because the county season is so congested, and because we can't guarantee weather at the beginning of the season, that we will move. It sounds like I don't know what the actual figures are, and I'm not sure if any actual figures have been put to it. But at least a few games will be moved abroad, perhaps to the Caribbean, at the beginning of the season, so that the English county season will start in March potentially, and go off from there. Which seems to me like a bit of a ludicrous solution to kind of the wrong question, because if the season is too is too crowded, then you do something about the season being too crowded, rather than, you know, we could absolutely technically be playing cricket 365 days a year if we spread it around the world, but actually the problem is the way that we have set up the season in England. I think that's what needs to be addressed, and it's actually kind of shirking the problem by trying to move it abroad.
And I mean, I think it displays a slightly odd disrespect towards the domestic leagues within those own countries, I think. I mean, the idea
the countries that we'd be touring to.
Right, or, so the idea that we'd take, you know, English domestic cricketers are there, when really, I'd like to think that, you know, we should be in favour of West Indies domestic cricket receiving its own support from home. And I think the problem is with some of these things, you sometimes come across really intractable, difficult problems. I just feel like the issue of county championship scheduling is quite a basic one. There is too much, and it's too erratically scheduled. It's not difficult. And the hope is that from next season, they have looked at regular start times for four-day games, regular days for 2020s every Friday night. And I think if they go with that, I think so many problems will be addressed overnight. A schedule we can follow will make things infinitely better.
Now, you might think that we just rant about cricket and we don't actually have any experience.
Don't get our hands dirty.
Of the coal face of the game. But actually, Andy, you've got a little story that shows us in a rather different light. Well, shows you in a rather different light, certainly.
Well, we've been chatting more and more about village cricket recently, and it does. It's a nice
now that the summer's here. You know,
now that summer is here, and I had what was both a low point and a high point a couple of weekends ago when I was dismissed for 49, which is one of those odd moments because. Normally, as someone who, you know, is normally quite happy and chuffed with himself if he makes it into the 20s, getting to 49 should really be a highlight, you know, something to go and celebrate. But I got to 49, and my teammates made the interesting decision not to inform me that I was on 49. Their logic being that I would have got very, very nervous had I known this.
Did you know in the back of your mind that you
No, I really didn't. I thought I was quite a bit short, actually. I thought I was maybe high 30s, maybe early 40s at most. And I rather idiotically sashayed down the wicket to a spinner and was stumped, which is not really what I tend to do anyway.
That's a cavalier way to go.
To have done it on 49 was particular. And I got back and I found my teammates all very reticent. And I thought, you know, it's a good innings. We're on track to win this game, which we don't do very often. And it was
PR spiel aside, because whenever you see players who are kind of out on 198 or something, they'll go, oh no, it wasn't about the personal team, and of course it would have been nice, but the more important thing is that we go on and win the game, blah, 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 blah. There must have been a bit of me that thought, God,
well, the funny thing, I was torn because, as I said, like, it was a good score to get, and it's nice to get into the 40s. I mean, I without wanting to be too depressed about this, I reckon it's probably 2 or 3 years since I got into the 40s. You know, we're talking, this is not a regular occurrence.
We're talking an absolute
we're talking a serious man. But it was an interesting reminder to me about how much value we put in these odd little landmarks, you know, in cricket. And I suddenly realised that actually, you know, being one short did matter, when in reality, it's like, it's one run, you know. Should it really be that relevant or that important?
A few episodes ago, we reviewed the excellent book Chinaman by Shehan Karunatilaka, which features a fictional cricketer, Pradeep Mathew, who is a spinner, and this is said of him. Mathew bowled 17 wides in a 191-run defeat to the West Indies. He was warned by the umpire of turning the game into farce after the mid-wicket ball against Pakistan, and was taken out of the attack against England by the skipper for using that bloody Karam bullshit. In this episode, Andy's going to introduce us to the mysteries of that Karam ball.
Well, we might as well start with what actually is a Karam ball.
And I'd love to, I have to say, I have no idea.
Well, and I found myself in this position as well. It's funny, I threw around the phrase Karam ball as if I knew what it was without actually any real understanding. The interesting thing is that the majority of deliveries in cricket are a variation on the established grip, right? So there's sort of spinner's grip, there is a the traditional seam grip, and you vary subtly to create a different effect. Karam ball requires an entirely different grip. And it's also a very sort of impractical grip. It's just an odd and uncomfortable grip.
We've just been trying it
with limited success.
Glasses were broken.
So, you have the ball grasped between primarily your thumb and your middle finger, with your index finger pressed back. And the inspiration, or at least the naming of the ball, is behind the Indian game of Karam, where you flick a counter with this same motion. So to bowl a Karam ball, you snap the fingers together at the moment of the release, and the ball is flicked out. And actually, it's quite interesting, if you read a lot of the commentary on Ashwin, who's a major Karam ball bowler, and Ajantha Mendis, the commentators often refer to this flicking. It's often the default phrase used to describe it. Now, depending on where the fingers are positioned at the point of release, it's possible for the ball to spin to off, spin to leg, or go straight on. I would love to be a lot more specific than this, except for the fact that different bowlers dispute exactly how it's done. One argument made is that it's where the central finger, so the index finger, is pointing at the point of release, is the direction it will break. But this isn't even well established, so adding further to the mystery.
And I suppose you talk about the mystery, and actually that's part of it, why it's so difficult to pick, presumably, as a batsman, is I've never had the privilege of facing a Karam ball.
You have enough problems with this
that there's such subtlety in the difference between the different balls. It's not the difference between a conventional leg spinner and a flipper where the hand is kind of completely the other way up.
No, and this is, I think, the key, actually, is that it is all about the sort of unfamiliarity of the action. It's not about ridiculous turn, actually. It's not that a Karam ball spins vastly more than, say, other deliveries. It's really about the fact that, as a professional batsman, you are very adept to watching the hand. You're very adept to watching the wrist to pick actions. And it becomes far harder with the Karam ball, something you're completely unfamiliar with. An interesting feature of it as well, and this you can perhaps understand when you see the flicking motion, is that it tends to have a very skiddy trajectory. It tends to go on. And actually, if you invest a good half an hour in YouTube, as I did, watching every Karam ball that's ever been bowled, you'll see that it quite often takes wickets just with the one that goes straight on, simply because it skids on a little bit too quickly. Now, the history. For a ball that's become really strongly associated with the subcontinent, its actual first prominent practitioner was an Australian, the legendary Jack Iverson, who has a story of his own that really deserves a From the Archives of his own. He gained the nickname Wrong Grip Jack for his Karam, Wrong Grip Jake even for his Karam ball. And his Test career saw him be picked up 21 wickets at 15 apiece. It was a brief Test career of just 5 Tests. The interesting story is that Lindsay Hassett, Australia's captain at the time, was determined to preserve the mystery. So there were Victoria players, New South Wales players, both in the Australian side, and he refused to let Iverson bowl to the New South Wales batsman because he was Victoria captain as well, Hassett, and he wanted to preserve the mystery. And I think this says a lot about the Karam ball, really. The secrecy is key.
And ultimately, that's presumably as well why it hasn't really spread, because actually there's... I mean, we were discussing a minute ago, we can't think of any English bowlers who have bowled the Karam ball, and actually, it is a real rarity, actually. I mean, there are things like the leg spinner, which is much easier to pick. Bill Bosanquet, who first bowled a flipper, say, everyone could see exactly how that works, and so you just sort of stood behind him in the net so you could work it out. But with something like the Karam ball, actually, the reason, presumably, why it hasn't spread is because it is this really subtle.
Well, the lack of spread, I think, is a genuine mystery, because when Iverson departed the game in the 50s, we didn't really see a well-documented Karam bowler until the arrival of Mendis and... I mean, there were others, but not really until the arrival of Mendis and Ashwin in the 2000s. And it kind of suggests, firstly, that I guess there wasn't the footage available, so people didn't pick it. But also the fact that perhaps it genuinely has an awkwardness to it that just makes it difficult. It makes it hard to spread. The Karen Ball bowler of our age really is Ajantha Mendis. And I remember very, very well him bursting onto the scene. And it was exciting. It was really thrilling. The thing I love about Ajantha Mendis is that he just doesn't look like a cricketer. He's such an unprepossessing. He's a tiny chap. And he burst onto the scene and was just causing routs everywhere. You know, he turned up and just nonchalantly ran through orders. First ODI he played against India takes 6 for 13 to secure victory in the Asian Cup. Dhoni afterwards just simply described him as unreasonable. And Osman Samyuddin, the Pakistani journalist...
Or unreadable. He was unreasonable. But
what did I say? I said unreasonable. Unreadable. May have been both.
Yeah. I presume it was unreadable.
But Samyuddin, the Pakistani journalist, said that Mendis's great achievement that night was that he made facing Murali look like a doddle, which I think is quite a compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, we come back to the element of surprise, because Mahela Jayawardene in this Asian Cup chose to rest Mendis from the group game against India so that the first time Indians would face him would be in the final.
Mm.
And that sort of gamesmanship, I guess, is quite interesting. But Mendis faced a challenge that Iverson never did, the super slow-mo relay and the army of video technicians that now accompany teams with them. And coaches responded to him, inevitably, by carefully dissecting the precise movements of his wrist and fingers. And the problem is, once you've done this and the analysis removes the mystery, Mendis becomes far less worrying. And if you look at his career from the start, it's tailed off fair... I mean, he remains a dangerous bowler. He continues to have reasonable success in the bowl in the IPL, continues to play for Sri Lanka, but he's a lot less, far less threatening. And I actually think he's likely to be remembered... He will go on to have a career probably far less successful than someone like Murali, far less successful than Shane Warne.
And I suppose for a ball as well that is... depending on that element of size rather than on the element of big spin. Because as you say, it never does turn a long, long way. It's simply that you're never sure which way it's going to turn or whether it's going to go straight on or not. That once you've actually been able to work out which way it's going to turn, there's never going to be the one that kind of, you know, turn 70 degrees and spits and you know, pits
this
up
is maybe where we
off.
Come to the problem with the Karen ball, because if you are reliant on mystery, and mystery can only last a short period of time, then is it possible to build a successful career on it, frankly? I mean, Shane Warne, who I, you know, with respect to Murray, I, you know, see Shane Warne as maybe the true spin great. And, you know, Warne was able to build that career through endless, like, accuracy and turn over a sustained period of time. It wasn't about a novelty ball. It wasn't about... And I think that's a key...
I think the thing about Mendis as well is that it's actually... Because there's no... because it's all about variation and subtly varying it in different directions. One of the things that I've kind of thought in the past... watching him play, particularly in one day, is it's actually very difficult to set a field to.
Mm.
Because there's no stock, there's no, you know, a leg spinner. An off spinner has their stock delivery, which if they put it in the right place, a catcher can set a field for and they know that it's not going to go for lots of runs. But with a Karen ball where you're having to vary it all the time, it's actually very, very difficult when one goes slightly wrong to have a field that can actually defend against that.
There's also an argument that's been made that it's not even certain whether Mendis or Ashwin actually have total control over it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, that there is an element of surprise to them. Interesting thing, again, going back in the story of it and how sort of Ashwin and Mendis developed it, they both talked about the fact that they used to bowl it while playing with a tennis ball, while playing street cricket. And you sort of wonder, well, would they have been this creative if they'd been playing in wonderful sort of county-approved facilities, receiving careful training? And I think the lesson perhaps you get out of this is, while it's very admirable that within England we have these excellent, excellent facilities and excellent programs for young cricketers, we do still need this experiment to mess around, and bowlers still need to be... Bowlers and batsmen actually still need to be encouraged.
We're going
to
go on and talk about Basil D'Oliveira later in the podcast, and there are stories of him, particularly late in his career, when his last tour, when he went to Pakistan and he played on a pitch that was completely disintegrating, and no one had ever seen a pitch like it, but he had, because he'd grown up playing in South Africa on pitches that were exactly like that, because they weren't cricket pitches.
And exactly, so actually... You need a variety in your development. It's not good enough to just play in perfect nets the entire time.
So what do you think have people kind of worked the Karen ball out? Do you think it's got a future?
Well, I think it certainly receives far less fear and respect that it did. I mean, Mendes has been tamed to a considerable extent. Ashwin has chosen to rely less and less on it. Again, unfamiliarity is key. There's a wonderful moment in the fourth test between India and Australia recently where Mitchell Johnson, who had not had the pleasure of facing Ashwin, was totally fooled by one. I mean, just beautifully fooled, left one that went on to clean him up. And, you know, those moments will still happen. I think amongst all of this, one thing shouldn't be forgotten. Bowling a carrom ball takes an incredible degree of skill. To propel the ball, to simply get it out of your hand from this unusual grip, is actually hard enough. To do so and land it with any degree of accuracy requires absolutely masterful control, and I think it's something that a lot of cricket admirers can and should respect. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Peter Oborne's prize-winning Basil D'Oliveira, the story of an extraordinarily talented cricketer and the astonishing controversy that followed him.
First published in 2004, this book took advantage of quite a lot of newly released papers to paint a very compelling picture of the entirety of D'Oliveira's life, but particularly the controversy that Andy's referring to that happened in 1968, again, about when he was initially not selected for a team to tour South Africa and then was selected for a team to tour South Africa. I suppose with D'Oliveira is one of those figures that all cricket fans and actually I think you know the wider public knows about in the back of their mind.
Without maybe knowing the details.
Without sort of knowing the detail. And one of the things that kind of constantly struck me whilst reading these books were those details that were constantly jumping out. Details about D'Oliveira, but also about South African politics, life in South Africa during apartheid. I mean, there's a remarkable story at the beginning, which you were saying that you'd read about in relation to Nelson Mandela, about the fact that someone was defined black or white by a pencil being put in their hair, and if it fell out, they were white, and if it stayed in, they were black.
Well, it's interesting because Peter Oborne is not a cricket writer, and he won the William Hill Sports Book of the Year for this, but he is a political journalist and political writer, and you can see he was attracted to this. I'm sure he's a cricket fan, but he was attracted to this because it is ultimately a political matter, it is a political subject. And I think the style of the book, it's incredibly readable, this. I think it's a very, very easy to read book. And I think it's a great advertisement for using pace well in a novel, in a book, because he uses the pace very much of a novel. The story kind of goes along very, very rapidly.
It's readable. I mean, I read this in across kind of three or four evenings, actually. Mm. And there's something that allows you to sort of grasp the whole in quite a nice way when it's that short.
And then it's interesting because he uses techniques that in a bad writer would be a gimmick. So he starts the story in the flat of the D'Oliveira family, waiting for the letter telling Basil that he will have the chance to go and play club cricket in England. From a bad writer, it would come across as not quite right. For a good writer, it comes across really well. Now, as a political journalist, do you feel he gets the politics in this? Do you feel he grasps it?
I think the for me, one of the really eye-opening things was this description of the politics. I think this is why it's such a successful book, actually, because it's not really, in a sense, a cricket book, as you say. It's about politics. The one sort of concern that I have is that at times I feel, not necessarily that he's sort of trying to prove a point, but that the political situation comes first and sometimes it's sort of read back onto the cricket, as it were, and things are read into the cricket that perhaps don't really exist. There's an anecdote about Peter Pollock, brother of Graham Pollock, who bowls a beamer at D'Oliveira in a game in England. Peter Pollock, who is a white South African, D'Oliveira, who's a black South African, has turned his back on South Africa, obviously. And Oborne says that the Pollock's beamer, quotes, could appear to be an expression of pent-up rage at the black man for his impudent defiance in daring to make his long journey from Signal Hill. And in a book where a lot is footnoted, there's a lot of evidence that is used to back up everything, and as I say, there's a lot of newly released evidence that's used. But actually, at times, you do sort of think he's trying to prove a point, and he's putting things in with a sort of a degree of poetic license.
It funnily enough, reminds me of History A-level, where I was very strongly taught that when you're reading Tacitus and Suetonius, the great Roman historians, be very sceptical of when they tell you what someone was thinking.
Yeah,
because
exactly,
you're not
exactly,
going to know
exactly,
what someone was thinking.
Exactly.
And I agree with you. I felt incredibly uncomfortable about that description, because it's aspiring a very... suggesting a crime that really has very little evidence for, and
exactly,
it's saying
a bouncer
it's
was
a
kind
serious
of
accusation.
An instrument of apartheid rather than a.
I think on this subject of a political narrative, there is a very memorable bit. So it's got to the point where D'Oliveira, after quite a middling summer, he's at the Oval and he's basically playing for his chance to tour South Africa, the dream of his life. and he goes to the Oval and plays this absolutely stunning innings, makes 158 and changes his career. And De Obourne suggests that this was still the greatest innings De Oliveira, or for that matter, any other cricketer has ever played. Cricket historians will make the case for Bradman's 334, Lara's 400. They're welcome to argue their case, but those runs were not scored under conditions of unspeakable personal difficulty against an attack comprising of Prime Minister Johannes Voorster and South African apartheid at its most savage, supported by the weight of the British establishment. Now, that is imposing very much. I mean, that is making that innings sound like a very much strongly political act. And I think my view on it is that De Oliveira was certainly burdened by an expectation from his own South African community that would
and
have made that.
And that is very well documented in the book.
And that is very well documented. The idea that his own community back home were looking for him. But to suggest that his innings was directly in opposition to apartheid, I mean, it suggests a level of politicisation that De Oliveira himself never had. I mean, maybe that's not his choice, right? Maybe those things are imposed on you.
And actually, a lot of the sort of... I found the book very poignant and actually very emotional in places, actually. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that De Oliveira is clearly completely out of his depth when it comes to all the political scheming and that the wider situation that's going on at the time. He is a cricketer. That's what he's good at. That's what he likes doing. And in a slightly odd way, it reminds me of Phil Brown, the photographer who we interviewed on the show. And I was talking to him about the restrictions the Indian board were putting on photographers. And he said, the really annoying thing is, I'm a photographer. I want to take photos. I don't want to be involved in the politics. Mm. And you get that kind of that sense coming across with Donald.
But I think
well.
It comes back to this bigger idea that I get very tired every time. I mean, I don't think we in our lifetimes have had a controversy quite on this scale in cricket. I mean, we've had things over, you know, do we go and play in Zimbabwe, all this sort of stuff, but maybe not quite on this scale. And I think it always comes down to people who come up with this trite line, oh, we shouldn't mix politics and sport. The De Oliveira story is the definitive example when politics and sport, whether you like it or not, will mix. And maybe whether De Oliveira were political or not was never really his choice. You know, he kind of had no option to it.
And given that, actually, I think we would struggle to have a better guide to the whole situation than someone who knows the politics of it so back to front as Peter Abel clearly does.
And I think it's much more than a biography, and one thing I really enjoyed in this that I think he could easily have missed out is the attention he gives to the lesser heroes of the story.
Yeah.
So John Arlott, I mean, both me and you were talking about, we never knew that he, not only as a journalist, went out of his way to make De Oliveira's career, to get him to England, stretch him here. Damu Banstar, who was a South African kind of cricket kind of impresario, who's sort of helping the game. You know, I think it was very important actually that you pay attention to these key figures, and you don't just make it a heroic novel of one person. You make it a story about him and the others who helped.
And ultimately, it really helps it as a novel, and it really helps it sort of as a piece of theatre to have the central narrative and then have these sort of war-torn roles that really do make a huge impact on the whole
heroes
story.
And villains.
For this episode's interview, I spoke to Chris Smith, who writes the excellent blog Declaration Game. It's worth noting that the interview took place before certain stories broke about David Warner. You'll see what I mean later on. But I began by asking him where he found the inspiration for his blog.
One of the things I think about cricket is that it's got this long history, which is fascinating, but I think also it means there's a lot of received wisdom that gets passed down the ages. And one of the things I like to do is pick up those things and test them and see whether empirically, perhaps with numbers, perhaps with experience, whether or not those things actually are borne out.
So how long do you spend writing the posts on average? Because some of them are incredibly detailed and you're obviously going off and, you know, drawing stats from all over the place.
Yes, I mean, the ones, for example, on declarations, I've done a lot of pieces on test match declarations. Those ones, you're right, they do take a long time. I might have to spend 3 or 4 evenings doing the research and then a couple of evenings putting it together into an article. So the ones that are statistics-based are certainly more time-intensive than the ones that are more around experience and observation.
And do you think that, obviously, cricket is a wonderful statistical game. Is it the statistics that does it about cricket for you?
One of the things, definitely. I mean, I do like numbers, but I like nothing more than sitting at Lord's on a sunny day and watching top level cricket. I like the aesthetics of the game. I like the elegance of batsmanship. I can't bowl, but I love watching bowlers. I love watching, you know, top class fielding. So certainly the numbers are important, but I enjoy the game on lots of different levels.
Alongside that aesthetical side of things, you obviously get your hands dirty, as it were, quite a lot with coaching and things like that. Can you tell me a bit about your other blog?
Yes, the Touchline Dad blog.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one I started earlier this year. I've got three children, and all of them are very sporty, certainly to a higher degree than I think I've ever achieved. And so I spend a lot of my life, when I'm not doing things around cricket or my professional life, I spend a lot of it on touchlines, watching them, supporting them. And I really am interested in the dynamic of parents, particularly dads, watching particularly their sons, because I think there's a very productive bonding between father and son, but it does very easily overflow into some not so pleasant behavior, which I often see on a Saturday or a Sunday when I'm watching my boys play and other parents taking things a little bit too seriously. So I think that there's a lot there in that relationship and how particularly men, but also some women, relate to junior sport that I like to unpick on the Touchline Dad blog.
Do your children know that they are the subjects of this writing?
No, they don't actually, Toby. So they're not going to be able to listen to this interview now.
Exactly, your moment of fame is going to be hidden. And can you as well as an interview, an invitation to an interview with Reverse Web Radio last week, you got quite an impressive contact, didn't you?
Yes, this was quite shocking. I got a tweet from a PR person who's involved in the launch of Will Smith's new film, and they've asked me to promote their film on the Touchline Dad blog, which I've gone ahead and done. It'll do them an awful lot of good, but I thought it was an opportunity worth taking.
Have you seen the film?
No, I didn't even know it was coming out, to be honest, Toby. Not really my type of medium, that.
It came out of nowhere. Interesting. So the reason that we started talking over Twitter last week, wasn't it? It was during the second New Zealand test.
Yes.
Was that we were having a kind of very limited, necessarily limited in 140 character conversation about spot fixing, and obviously the everything happening in the IPL was all breaking then, and various bits of news continue to break. And you wrote a blog post on the subject and about the possible fallout from spot fixing. Can you just kind of outline your view on that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think my views on spot fixing are pretty conventional, in that, you know, it's a detestable activity. I actually wrote it before the IPL latest expose. I wrote it directly after Danish Canaria's appeal hearing occurred, so it was a little bit. So it actually didn't have the benefit of the most recent expose, but it was really just an observation that, you know, we've had these bits of news, these sad bits of news about corruption in cricket for the last 10 years, and what occurred to me is that for those 10 years, we've been hearing the same dramatic language. Mm. Typically, the word cancer in the game, that gets used a lot, and that spot fixing and match fixing are the biggest threat out there to cricket. And I just reflected on that, and I thought, well, we've had 10 years of this biggest threat of this cancer, but is the game actually any the weaker for it? Mm. Because surely if it was that big a threat, then we would have experienced the damage already. So I started putting the question out on Twitter: has anyone, or does anyone know anyone, who has stopped following cricket because of spot fixing? And I put it out on Twitter and I put it out on LinkedIn, and I haven't yet actually had anyone say yes, I know someone. I think maybe you did, Toby, in one of your responses to me.
Well, I was actually reading a blog today by, it was on Crick Info, by the chap who's a philosophy professor living in Brooklyn, whose name I've just completely forgotten.
Oh, I know who you mean, yeah.
Who was saying that he, and this was kind of reflecting what I was thinking before, and he was saying that on the morning of the IPL final, he kind of texted some friends and said, come on, let's watch the game, let's watch the game. But in a sense, when there are events happening off the field that distracts from the kind of pure drama of the game, if you're always thinking about something else that might be going on, and that it might not be someone, you know, striving to be the very best that they are, but actually that they're trying to, you know, win some money in some regard or something like that, it actually sort of shifts the, and here I'm slightly moving away from his arguments, it sort of shifts the relationship between the game and the fans. There's a kind of pact between the game and the fans. The fans are sort of buying into something literally and metaphorically. And if that's changed and actually the game's about something completely different, then I think that's something that needs to be controlled, perhaps.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm with you, and I think I am very conventional in I would want it driven out of the game, although I don't think it could ever be driven out of the game.
Yeah.
And I think, logically, I think that argument is absolutely spot on, but it doesn't seem as though, I'm listening for people to tell me I'm wrong. Mm. It doesn't actually seem to have deterred people from following the game, and that then led me down the line of what is it about cricket that makes it resilient to good, strong evidence of corruption? I'm sure have all watched games which have since turned out to have had perhaps not been match fixed, but certainly had incidents fixed within them, and yet our commitment remains to the game. And I came up with an analogy, and I don't know whether it's one that other people would share, but cricket is a drug.
Mm.
And the spot fixing is like a street drug that we've bought that's been cut with talcum powder or something, and it gives us a bad high for that particular incident, and maybe we don't watch the next week. But we're back into it soon enough, because cricket has something enduring that keeps tugging us back.
Just drawing together your experience as well of coaching children, when children are coming into the game, do you think they're affected by things like the IPL, or does that seem so distant, and actually the way that they get into the game and the way that they get hooked to the game is through playing at school and within that quite sort of close-knit and immediate environment, and what's happening in international cricket is kind of a million miles away?
That's an interesting one. I think direct experience is that a lot of children get their exposure to the game because their parents play, which is something I've written about, because I think there's a lot of criticism of parents who just drop their kids off at cricket training or a cricket match and come back at the end. And I've heard it said at my club, oh, it's just glorified babysitting, that's all they want us for. My view is that that's exactly what we should be doing. Mm. It's easy enough to get the children whose parents already play to start playing, but for cricket to be enduring, we need to get the children of the parents who don't play. And if we're providing a babysitting function as coaches to do that, I'm perfectly happy with that. I don't expect every adult, every parent to want to spend time, particularly where I live in the chilly north, sitting on the boundary watching their child play. Just great that they bring them along, pay their subs to the club, and give their son or daughter an opportunity to get into cricket. But I guess other kids, I mean, what I personally think is the biggest threat to cricket is the lack of exposure of children, be it to playing or to watching. And I grew up, perhaps like you, watching hour upon hour through the summer holidays of cricket. And my children get to see a little bit of IPL on ITV4, but not a lot else.
Okay. Just looking into the future, gaze into your crystal ball, and we're 10 years down the line. What one thing do you think we'll remember about this summer?
I think we will have an innings by David Warner where he applies all his brilliant one-day short form cricket to the Test match arena and blows England apart for 2 or 3 hours. And I think that will probably be the most memorable part of the summer. I hope it's Joe Root whose batting is the most memorable part. But I just have a feeling that Warner's going to come good at least once during the series and do something really quite extraordinary.
We're currently in the middle of the final ever Champions Trophy, which is going to be abolished to make way for the World Test Championship. And this episode, we are going to be debating whether the Champions Trophy will be missed.
The Champions Trophy has always been the sort of odd sibling in the kind of ICC tournament family. No one's quite obviously sure what it's there for. I mean, if you've got a 50-over World Cup, why have the Champions Trophy as well? But it's always been, in my opinion, an outstanding format because it has everything that the World Cup doesn't. Key thing, every game pretty much matters in the Champions Trophy. That's because of a format that's actually much more based on things like the Football World Cup, where you have a small group stage straight into a knockout. And you don't get these endless games that sort of don't matter, or that matter sort of at most for pride. More crucially than that, however, is the level of the cricket and the standard of the cricket. And much as we sort of enjoy getting behind the minnows and that variety, having the top eight teams in the world competing generally guarantees you a really high standard of cricket, as we've seen in this current tournament. And I think perhaps the other sort of key feature of this as a whole is that it leads to a very taut tournament that is easy to follow and that is over in really barely a couple of weeks. And if you contrast that with the World Cup that drags and drags and drags, I think the Champions Trophy will be missed simply because it is a very well-designed tournament that oddly seems to do better everything that the World Cup that we're going to keep still does.
I mean, it's very difficult to argue with any of that, to be honest, and actually on all of those points I agree with you completely. What I would say is that there is obviously congestion in the calendar, so ultimately if you accept, as the ICC does, that the World Cup is the World Cup, then and you want to bring in a Test Championship, then you have to get something.
Is that a case for just saying, let's call the Champions Trophy the World
Cup?
Well,
exactly. So this is going to be my slightly perverse argument. And I'm going to say that the Champions Trophy isn't going to be missed because actually the powers that be are going to have a moment of enlightenment and they're going to say, actually, exactly for the reasons that you've pointed out, the Champions Trophy is a wonderful thing. Let's take that format and impose it into, well, not impose it, but use it for the World Cup. And, yeah. that actually, I don't see a way really that they can ignore that. Because, I mean, the last few World Cups have been an absolute farce. I mean, hardly anyone's gone to them. They've become kind of meaningless in a way. And what I would really hope is that we're not going to miss the Champions Trophy because it's going to become the World Cup, and so we're, you know, it's still going to be there.
I mean, I think the interesting thing is the point about congestion is the endless thing in cricket. I mean, it's the thing that curses everything from
but
the
actually,
Slider.
I think the Champions Trophy
is an efficient
tournament. Yeah, exactly. I mean, just you know,
it's an unbelievably efficient tournament.
Just to argue against the side of the debate that I'm supposed to be arguing on, I completely agree with you that actually it's a little bit like this. Idea that the ECB have had of taking county matches abroad. You think no, don't sort of pander to your over congestion. Actually, do something about it. And the Champions Trophy is a good model
of that. The idea of a tournament. I mean, for example, Pakistan are now out. West Indies are actually slightly more unluckily, more due to weather than anything else, are now out. But I like the idea of a tournament where you lose twice and you're going home. I think that's fair. I think that's reasonable. I mean, the only argument against has always been the fact that, you know, we need the minnows involved. And I think that is the challenge. And this is, again, you know, subject for a whole different debate.
But the question,
how
the
do
question
best
is,
develop
the... But the question is where you need the minnows. Because I would actually rather have a World Cup that was like the Champions Trophy and a Champions Trophy that was like the World Cup.
Mm.
Swap them around. Get the minnows involved in something that isn't your absolute... I mean, I'm all for giving minnows kind of publicity. But I don't think you should have them in your... I don't think you should wreck... You should cut off your nose to spite your face, and you should wreck your flagship tournament simply for the sake of wanting to happen.
I mean, I think there's a case for saying that you could have a minnows qualification, as you do for the World Cup, but make it a lot tighter and at most let one, maximum two sides in there and so forth. Because I think the key feature that really kills the World Cup and doesn't kill the Champions Trophy are one-sided games. And one thing that I think has been so compelling about this Champions Trophy so far is you just have had lots and lots of competitive, balanced cricket.
It's also just being able to follow it. I mean, obviously, we both follow a lot of cricket. With World Cups, I really do genuinely lose interest. It's the IPL effect.
Yeah.
Whereas with this Champions Trophy, you've actually, the fact they've had they haven't had more than one game per day, and yes, it's not going on for more than three weeks. It actually, I'm not sure exactly how long it is, but it's
actually
longer than
2 weeks.
It actually enables you to actually really get a sense of what's going on and begin to follow things. So we're 47 episodes in, and I think that's the first time that we've ever actually agreed on something in the podcast. Hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and join us next week, where we'll probably be back to our old form and falling out again.